This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure for me to have in the studio one of the best environmental activists in the country. Her name is Wilma Subra. She's a chemist, and as such, she's helped about 1,000 communities analyze the risks they face from corporate polluters and others. Wilma Subra won a MacArthur Genius Grant about a decade ago for her tremendous work, and she's been outspoken recently about the lingering and dangerous effects of last year's BP oil spill. Wilma Subra, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a thrill to meet you because when I was reading about you, you were someone I should have known about it for a long time, and I'm glad I have the opportunity to meet you, and I'm glad our listeners get a chance to hear about you too. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your background?
Well, I have my own company since 1981 to provide technical assistance to community groups because I worked for a research institute for 14 years prior to opening my own company, and I saw the desperate need for someone to work on behalf of the communities, helping them understand what all this information and data really meant as far as they were concerned.
And tell me how you got interested in that field in the first place.
I'm the oldest of six girls, and my father was an inventor and had a facility that he had a chemistry lab in. And so during the summer from seventh grade on, I worked in his office taking the place of people as they took their vacations, and I took the place of the chemists when the chemists went on vacation. And I always liked all the sciences and all the maths. And so when I went to college, I majored in chemistry, microbiology, and at that time, the beginning phases of computer science.
And were you one of the few women in the chemistry microbiology field then?
I was.
College? What was that like? Were you a victim of sexism or aware of the sexism around you because of that?
Oh, no. That was never an issue.
Not an issue.
Not an issue.
But you're always stellar at science, I take it.
Yes.
And are you still love science?
Absolutely.
What is it about science that is so fascinating for you?
It's so to the point. You have data, and the data proves the issues. And so it just leads you down the path of this is what the science is saying, and this is what impact the science is showing that it has on the community groups.
Now, Wilma Subra, you decided to stay in Louisiana. I imagine you could have gone to more lucrative or prestigious pastures. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to stay there?
Well, that was interesting because everyone in graduate school who did well went off out of Louisiana. When I was finishing up my graduate degree, the legislature was trying to stop brain drain in Louisiana, and they formed a research institute. And true to Louisiana fashion, they couldn't decide where to put it, so they put it in three locations, and one of those locations was New Iberia. So it was a great opportunity. It was a great opportunity to stay and deal with the people in Louisiana who desperately needed help. And even working at the research institute, and we were doing cancer studies and tox studies before there were even those kind of programs in universities, the community came, knocked on the door, and we work with them at nights and weekends.
So tell me how that happens. The community comes and knocks on the door. Is that literally what happens, or how do you hear about community? How did you originally hear about community concerns so that you decided to devote so much of your work to helping communities?
Communities actually came and knocked on the door of the university, of the research institute. They had already started coming knocking on the door of the university when I was in graduate school, saying, you know, what does this mean? We've got a polluted river. We hear polluted, but we don't understand what it means. And so they knock on the door, they call you up and desperately say, I really, really need help understanding what's going on. And now email from around the world is how they get in touch with me.
And when they got in touch with you at first, what would you do? Would you get your waders on and go take samples?
Well, first I'd ask them what they knew about the situation. And then I'd go to the state agencies and see what was in the file. Then I would have a workshop with them. Sometime it was around the kitchen table, showing them this is what the data shows. This is where we have gaps in the data. We can ask the state agency to fill those gaps, or we can raise $100 to fill the gap. And so you started working with them. You'd bring them to the state capitol. You'd bring them to the legislature. You'd bring them to the environmental committee meetings. And they would sit there and tell the agencies, this is what's going on in my community.
Now, would the state have good data, or was it not up to speed?
The state had good data in some cases, not up to speed in the other cases. And it was interesting because at the time, the state agency was on a number of floors. And if there was a particular site, I'd go on each floor and look at the files because everything was paper copies. And then I'd go tell the state agencies where all their data was on this particular site because there was no communication between the floors.
One hand didn't know what the other hand had, huh?
Correct.
Well, that's a problem. Now, when you do samples yourself, do you ever worry that you are going to get ill? Do you ever get ill? Do you ever worry you're going to diminish your own life expectancy?
Well, no, I'm very careful. I protect myself when I'm out doing the samples, and that's not an issue.
And what about threats, death threats? Have you received death threats from, I know you go after some big companies.
Yes, me and my family has been threatened. Also, I've been the victim of a drive-by shooting.
Really? What happened there?
I was working one night about 7 o'clock on a summer night preparing for a National Environmental Justice Advisory Council meeting that I was going to give a presentation. And my husband, we live around the corner. My husband was out in the yard late in the afternoon working in the flower beds when it was, quote, a little cooler in Louisiana. And this car kept driving back and forth in front of my office. And when it came back, and it was driving very slowly, and when it came back, the passenger shot at my office, and I was sitting right near the front window. My husband immediately called the sheriff because he always has his cell phone in case I need anything, and they stopped him at the intersection. The passenger was gone. The gun was gone, and the driver said he didn't know anything about it. Since that time, we've never seen that vehicle again.
They never solved that crime?
And never saw the gun. Then the issue from the sheriff's perspective is it would violate the individual who was driving the car's human rights if he gave us the name of the individual that was driving the car.
Well, that does not sound like good law enforcement to me. Do you worry about your safety?
I do. I'm very cautious. And as a result of the drive-by shooting, I put bulletproof windows all across the front, and I moved everything to the back office. So when I'm there, I'm not physically up against the front.
And when did this happen?
In 2007.
That's terrible.
And then prior to that, my office was broken into all over and over again. And they'd steal the microwave. They'd steal the fax machine. They'd eat the food out of the kitchen area, not the lab area. And when the sheriff came, he'd always say, you know, this is someone harassing you.
So this courageous woman I'm talking to is Wilma Subra. She's a chemist. She runs her own company, Subra Company, right?
Correct.
Not Subaru Company. She's the award winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant for all her work helping more than 800 communities in Louisiana examine some of the pollutants that surround them. And you mentioned that you were about to give a speech on environmental justice. A lot of your work deals with environmental justice, or also called environmental racism. Explain how you became familiar with that.
Well, I had requests from a lot of environmental justice communities to help them out and work with them, even before the environmental justice term was coined. And then when environmental justice term was coined, then they were identified totally separate from the other communities. And they are the ones that are the most vulnerable. They are the poorest, the most in need, and lack the ability at that time to get things done.
Is it just real obvious in Louisiana that the polluting companies are in poor and minority communities?
For the most part, yes. What happened along the Mississippi River is the big industrial facilities bought up plantations because they needed the riverfront access on the Mississippi, and they need the rail lines. And what happened when the slaves were freed is the plantation owners gave the slaves property along the edge of the property of the plantation, and that's where they built their homes. And they passed these homes down from generation to generation and never probated wills. So when the big industrial facilities came in, they bought the plantation. But in Louisiana, we're under the Napoleonic Code, so you don't buy property you can't get clear access to. And that's why these communities were left behind and the industrial facilities were developed on the plantation. So they are the fence line communities.
So you can see where the rich white folks live. It's not where the polluting company is.
Correct. All the rich white people have moved further inland away from the polluting industrial facilities.
And then is there a real split about how serious the issue of pollution is in a community because some people are affected and some people aren't?
Yes, the real split is jobs versus the environment. The industrial facilities pay really well, and so the people who have jobs there assume that you're threatening their livelihood when you deal with the communities that are right on the fence line and are being heavily impacted day in and day out.
And how do you respond to that?
That these people deserve to have a good quality of life, and these people deserve to have human health, and that they're left behind, and these issues really need to be addressed on their behalf.
I'm speaking with Wilma Subra. She is a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. She's done incredible environmental activism as a chemist, as a professional chemist in Louisiana, using her expertise to help out communities, often communities of color, examine the risks that polluters are foisting upon them. And now I want to talk about BP for the last part of this program, because you were there when the huge oil spill happened last year. What was your initial reaction when you saw that thing blow?
When the rig blew, there were a number of workers from the Acadiana area, which is where I live, that were on the rig. And we immediately started helping out the families, because the issue was that they couldn't get in touch with their loved ones. Even the ones that were rescued by the supply boat weren't allowed to call home. They had satellite phones and they weren't allowed to use them. So the families had to wait until the boat came on shore, which was almost 24 hours. So we were dealing with that. And then 2 days later on Earth Day, April 22nd, the rig sank. So that was really a detriment to those families, because they thought, well, maybe they'd be able to recover the bodies, but now they weren't going to be able to. And from that point on, the issue of the oil coming on shore, the potential of the damage it was doing, the fishing community immediately lost all their ability to earn a living. They wanted to go to work for BP because they knew the marshes and estuaries, and they thought they'd be able to protect what resources they needed to live. What happened is BP made them sign away all their rights. So we had to go to court on behalf of the fishermen to get that thrown out so that they weren't required to sign away their long-term and short-term rights.
Now, these were rights to compensation?
Rights to compensation, rights to damages.
Economic and health damages?
Sure, economic and health. So everything would have been, you've got a job, that's all you get is the pay. You won't have any economic benefits. You won't have human health benefits.
And so did you win that? Did the court throw those signatures out?
We did. We won it within 7 days. The court held a hearing and made BP, who was attending the hearing, sign an agreement. But the problem was that from the very first, the fishermen weren't adequately trained. And the minute they went out and started pulling in the booms full of the oil, they became very, very sick, not protected. So working with Louisiana Environmental Action Network, we bought protective gear and distributed it to them.
The company didn't provide that gear.
The company didn't provide adequate training, didn't provide protective gear. And then BP told them if they wore that protective gear, they were fired.
Really? And did they go and fire people?
They did. And we started doing workshops along the coast, educating the communities about what the health impacts were. And the family started realizing that's what we're experiencing. The wives started speaking out. The workers were told, if your wife doesn't shut up, you're fired.
Mm-hmm. And how did it proceed from there?
Well, from there, Mary Lior and I of Louisiana Environmental Action Network actually had to go to all the federal agencies. I had a meeting with Dr. Michaels of OSHA saying, this is what's really going on in the community. And he says, we have a problem. I said, yes, we do. He said, but you know, if we make those workers wear a respirator, they're going to die of heat stroke.
Because that's not true, though, is it?
It was 100 degrees in the morning.
So what would their answer have been there?
Their answer was not requiring them to wear respirators, not requiring them to wear full Tyvek suits. And the ones that were working along the beach, doing beach cleanup, they reduced them to working 20 minutes an hour and putting them in the shade and providing them with liquids for the other 40 minutes.
How do you assess BP's response to this spill?
BP spread a lot of resources, financial resources, around to the right locations to make people be quiet and say that it's not a real big deal. And we're still hearing that today. In July, we started hearing all the oil is gone. We started going out and assessing where the oil was, taking samples of the water, the sediment, the soil, the fish tissue, crabs, oysters, and
what were you finding?
Shrimp. We were finding polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons with the same fingerprint as the BP crude. So they were definitely contaminated with the BP crude, not someone else who dumped something along the side of the road. We also demonstrated that the Food and Drug Administration established safe levels for the fish and that those levels were not protective enough.
I read an example that you cited about shrimp. I mean, people in Louisiana eat a lot of shrimp. I love shrimp, too, and I eat it when I'm down there. And one of the standards, correct me if I'm wrong, was people who eat four or five shrimp a week. That can't be the minimum intake of shrimp for shrimp eaters in Louisiana, is it?
That's correct. When you sit down to eat shrimp along the Gulf Coast in Louisiana, you eat a lot more than four. And people that are fishing community people, they eat their catch and they feed it to their family, and no one serves four shrimp a week as a meal.
And did people laugh at that when they saw that?
They didn't laugh. They were appalled. They said, well, how did they establish these levels? And so you start explaining to them, and you say, and the fish consumption is four jumbo shrimp a week. And they go like, well, we know we eat more than that.
And so now we're in 2011, and are the fish and the shrimp still contaminated by your studies?
The fish and the shrimp are still contaminated. Now, bear in mind that they are below the level established by the Food and Drug Administration, which we think is inadequate. They are contaminated with what's called oil range organics, which is the largest component of the BP crude, but FDA didn't establish levels for oil range organics. We're collecting fish and shrimp and oysters that have as much as 1% oil range organics. Oof.
That sounds enormous, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
And what are the health effects if you consume that?
Well, the short-term health effects are things like respiratory problems, headaches, nausea, vomiting, and then the long-term effects are cardiovascular, skin lesions, a lot of lymph node swelling, and liver and kidney damage. And what we're seeing now is starting to see the chronic impacts because it's been 6 months. And there are still workers out there that are still coming in contact with the crude oil every day.
And what are some of those chronic things you're seeing?
Cardiovascular.
Already.
Decreased lung function. And then just lesions all over their bodies and liver and kidney impacts.
Huh. I'm speaking with Wilma Subra, who is a chemist and environmental activist in Louisiana, a winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Has done incredible work for decades now. Helping local communities and has really been at the point of the spear on this BP cleanup issue. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. So how should we, the country, the government, address this problem?
The desperate need right now is to have medical staff available to treat all of these very sick people. And that medical staff has to clearly understand what they're exposed to and the associated health impacts.
And who would do that, though? The government through the health department should do that? The federal government? The state government?
we would like the support of the medical schools, of the government agencies, to provide this kind of medical assistance. Right now, there are just a few doctors who are going out of their way to try and treat all of these people who are very, very sick.
Well, what about CDC or the National Institutes for Health? Where are they on this?
We have, in fact, communicated with them over and over again. There's going to be a meeting in Louisiana next week where National Institutes of Health is going to come and talk about the program that they've established. They received $10 million from the federal government, $10 million from BP to do health tracking. And they will track the health of 75,000 workers and volunteers. But they will not provide the medical treatment.
Well, I was going to say there's tracking and then there's treating.
Right.
And who's going to do the treating?
They said they don't have sufficient resources. So that was a communication last Friday. They called and said, you know, you're talking about all these people who are very sick, and you know we can't do that as part of our tracking. I said, I'm aware of that. I've been participating as you scoped out this endeavor. I think the endeavor is really worthwhile. But if you need to treat these people, just identifying that they're sick and tracking them for the long term, if you don't provide medical treatment, they're desperate.
Right, and it's really got to come from the federal government because state governments are so over the barrel as far as budgets go.
Right.
I'm sure that's true in Louisiana, isn't it?
More so than ever in Louisiana.
And so if there's not movement from the federal government, what's going to happen?
These people will stay sick, and these chronic conditions are going to last for the rest of their life.
Hmm. And that just must be so painful for you, Wilma Subra, a chemist, a scientist, by training, just to see this terrible destruction going on. Does it make you despair or feel helpless ever?
It makes me more committed than ever. I get phone calls constantly. I get emails constantly. Yesterday morning when I was trying to leave to go to the airport, the phone just kept ringing, more and more people saying, I'm really sick. I really need your help. Hmm.
So that must give you energy then?
Yes.
Having people come to you and ask for your help.
Mm-hmm.
What can people do who are not in Louisiana or not in positions of government to help the people of the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and other parts of the land down there who've been affected by this BP spill? I mean, it's kind of gone from people's minds now. It comes back at anniversary time, and then it goes again, and people
right.
act like it's not a problem anymore, and they see shrimp on their menus, so everything's fine. That seems to be a crude assessment of the general mood, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm far north of Louisiana.
Anyone who has connections to the medical community can put pressure on the federal agencies to provide what we need. In Louisiana, if you're a medical doctor and you're not licensed in Louisiana, you're not allowed to practice. So it would be great if we could have some medical staffs come down, but then the state of Louisiana is going to throw up their hands and say, you're not licensed here, you can't practice. But pressure on the national level would really help what's going on in Louisiana.
And how do we get justice for the people who have been injured or who are ill right now? I mean, there's one thing to get tracking. There's another thing to get treatment.
Right.
And there's a final thing to get justice. And
well,
how do you do that?
They've been doing the payments, and that was one of the issues, is that the individual who's in charge of the payment hired a consultant to estimate how long the damages were last. And the report that came out said 2 years for fish and shrimp and 4 years for oysters. So he's basing the payment on that. But at the same time, he's saying, but I'm not paying for medical. I'm not paying for human health impacts. So we need a program that will pay for their human health impacts.
That just seems so wrong. I mean, the estimation may be a low ball too, but just to say they're not going to pay for the health impacts.
Exactly.
And who was it who was saying that? A government official who's administering the payout scheme?
Right. The government officials that are administering the BP resources that they're paying to these individuals.
And can your legislators in Louisiana put pressure on the Obama administration to get that administrator to be a little more humane?
Oil is king in Louisiana. And what we do is we protect oil at all costs. So there's a real reluctance. There's one legislator that's attempting to put some pressure.
I'm speaking with Wilma Subra, a chemist and environmental activist in Louisiana, who's done incredible work there for decades and recently has been doing incredible work on this BP issue. Oil is king in Louisiana, you say. And tell me about oil being king and the drive to get more deep-sea oil drilling going on, unbelievably, even after this horrible disaster.
The fishing community is also the oil company workers. A lot of times these fishing communities work on the off-season, or their cousin or their brother works for the oil industry. So it's ingrained all the way down to the very, very lowest levels. The service companies and the oil and gas companies have damaged and destroyed the environment in Louisiana for many, many, many decades. And they continue to hold this as their way of life. If you go down to the legislature, if the environmental communities gets their turn to testify, the oil industry feeds the legislators in the back room. So the legislature walks out and eats lunch in the back room while your time to testify.
Literally feeds them. I imagine feeds them questions, too.
Of course. And the industry is in the environmental agencies and Office of Conservation, which is the oil and gas agency, on a daily basis. So they have the resources to be able to manage the government of Louisiana.
And to some extent, they manage the government of the United States of America, too, I'm afraid. What would your prescription be as far as offshore oil and drilling goes?
Well, the interesting thing is that the offshore oil, once you pass 3 miles out, becomes a federal issue. However, in Louisiana, where the largest part of offshore drilling occurs off our shore, all the waste comes into Louisiana. And then the oil and the gas get distributed around the rest of the country. So we have had to deal with all the waste issues, yet the rest of the country enjoys the benefits of having sufficient natural gas and oil. So our legislature has to say, we have to get some of the goods of this. They've been talking about additional revenues coming in, and then at the same time, there's a big shale gas play in North Louisiana, the Haynesville Shale, and our legislature in Louisiana just gave them a 2-year exemption from paying royalties so they could recoup the capital investment.
Well, but that's a ripoff too, so the state's not going to get the tax revenues from that.
Exactly.
Do you think there should be a ban on all offshore drilling?
That will never happen because it's already there off Louisiana's coast and because so many of the other states don't want it. But it has to be done safely, and the issue is if the regulations that are on the books aren't enforced, even adding new regulations that aren't enforced isn't going to help. You need the enforcement.
And they weren't enforced for this
BP
thing.
Little to no enforcement.
Hmm. And what's going to happen to increase that enforcement? Is that happening now?
Well, they've redone some of the federal agencies that are supposed to be overlooking that, and they've separated the permitting or the issuing of the permits for the wells. They've separated that from the regulatory compliance and enforcement. So we're hoping that that has a positive impact.
Well, there's a shred of hope after a long conversation of a lot of things that have gone wrong down with this BP oil spill. But it's been a huge pleasure of mine. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive. I've been speaking with Wilma Subra, who's this environmental activist and chemist doing extraordinary work in Louisiana. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
And I guess people could go to Louisiana Environmental Action Network if they want more information, or is there a website for your company you want to give out?
Yeah, the work I've been doing on the BP spill is on the LEAN website, leanweb.org.
Okay, thanks again.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.